Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the new cabinet was sworn in last Friday. We'll assess those appointed and those disappointed.
Friday was certainly not a happy day for everyone. Protesters showed up to the swearing-in ceremony to declare that 50K is not okay. We'll explain what they meant by that.
Nearly 40 years of covering elections, and this was my first without any post-ceremony news conferences.
And that might be just as well, because the real news will come on Budget Day Take 2. We'll look ahead to that.
It's Tuesday, June 28th, 2022, so let's get to it. JMM, you survived the shuffle okay. It was not exactly what you would call nice breezy weather outdoors last Friday. It was pretty darn hot.
That front lawn at Queen's Park gets a lot of sun, and my people were not built to tan well.
You don't tan, you stroke, as Woody
Allen
once
exactly.
said. Well, let's go through some of the goings-on from last Friday, and I guess the best place to start is with the person who got the biggest promotion, and that would be Sylvia Jones, the Dufferin-Caledon MPP. She is now the new health minister. She is also the deputy premier. I think it's fair to say she got those promotions because she has presented herself over the past few years, as Solicitor General in the past, as a real problem solver for Doug Ford. And by that, let me just remind everybody of one of the bigger scandals in the Ford ministry going back a few years. Doug Ford needed a new commissioner for the Ontario Provincial Police, a new chief commissioner, and he wanted his old buddy from Etobicoke, Ron Tavener, who was 72 years old, I believe, at the time, to get the job. Well, there was quite a firestorm of reaction, because the idea was you don't put one of your buddies as the head of the OPP, you put somebody who actually has a demonstrated track record of being able to do the job, and, you know, you shouldn't be treating the OPP as kind of your own private little police squad, which is what the criticism at the time was. Well, Tavener got increasing amounts of heat. Sylvia Jones, as Solicitor General, entered the fray. She suggested Thomas Carrick for the job. He was the York Region Chief at the time. She knew him well. She thought he could do the job. I ask anybody, have you heard about OPP scandals in the last 3 years as it relates to the Chief Commissioner? No, you haven't, because Carrick has done the job, and Sylvia Jones, got kudos for resolving that issue. One other thing, I guess, was noteworthy, at least one, from the shuffle last Friday, and that is, for the last 6 months, we've had an interim long-term care minister in the province after Rod Phillips' departure. Paul Calandra from York Region has been doing the job on an interim basis, and now JMM, he's got the permanent job.
He has, I guess, apparently decided he will enjoy doing this job on top of the other hats he wears in cabinet. He is the government house leader. This is the position of basically managing relations with the other opposition parties and just trying to smoothly get the government's agenda through the legislature. And he's also the Minister of Legislative Affairs. And that is a separate but related title, I guess you could say, because if you've ever been down at around, let's say, Bay and Wellesley in downtown Toronto, you can see that there's actually a lot of construction work happening in the legislative precinct. And Paul Calandra is stick handling a lot of that work as part of his role as Minister of Legislative Affairs. But the fact that he's wearing this many hats as a cabinet minister has led to some criticism. After the cabinet was announced on Friday, NDP caucus chair Jeff Birch, he's newly elected by the caucus to that role, he gave some remarks in a press conference, and he said it was a slap in the face to people who had lost relatives and loved ones in long-term care homes. Since Calandra is, as Birch put it, you know, acting as a part-time long-term care minister. This is just one of three jobs he's holding right now. The NDP clearly saying that, you know, this should really be the kind of job that one person has to focus on as their sole focus. Obviously, long-term care, just one of the many sectors in the province that is going to require a lot of work to bring all the way out of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, when we talked a week ago, you and I talked about the fact that there are usually two different kinds of shuffles. One is sort of the major, you know, real, let's put a new coat of paint on this thing and lots of people changing positions. And the other is sort of some tinkering at the edges. Well, as we saw last Friday, this was more of the latter, tinkering at the edges. All the major portfolios basically stayed with the people who had them before, with the one exception of health. And that means Stephen Lecce is still the Minister of Education in the province of Ontario, as you anticipated. You want to tell us what's on his calendar for the next year or so?
The big thing that is going to be on his calendar, on his plate, is going to be negotiating with education unions. We say education unions, people automatically think about really the four big teachers unions in the province, but there is more to it than just that. There are education workers beyond just teachers in Ontario's education system, and they all have collective bargaining agreements that will need to be negotiated with. One of the key demands for public sector unions around the province right now is either repealing Bill 124 outright. This is, we've talked about it many times on this podcast before, the legislation that restricts pay increases for unions in the broader public sector. At the moment, basically, it is illegal for pay to increase at even a fraction as quickly as inflation is eroding people's earnings. So that's obviously something that the unions would like to address. One other issue, though, that came up in the cabinet shuffle, as you said, most of the files, most of the major files were left to people who held them previous to the election. And then there's the case of Michael Ford. He is, of course, the nephew of Doug Ford, former Toronto City Councillor, before that a school trustee. His file is the Citizenship and Multiculturalism. He represents one of the, I would say it's fair to say, one of the more diverse ridings, a underserved riding in the city of Toronto. And so the premier's defenders will say that, you know, he can play a really valuable role in cabinet by bringing representation for his area to cabinet. But of course, this has raised a lot of questions about, you know, the propriety of the premier appointing his nephew to cabinet. It comes with a substantial pay bump and a lot more prominence. There are lots of MPPs, including people with a lot more political experience, who did not get a seat in cabinet. But Steve, you wrote something for TVO.org about this. What do you have to say about this?
Yeah, I'm actually, you know, obviously I'm not going to take a position on whether he should or should not have been appointed to the role, but I do lay out in the column some of the arguments that no doubt took place in the back rooms of the premier and his advisors. No doubt, the advisor said to the premier, you know, your nephew's 28. You know, he hasn't been in politics all that long. You can spend the currency, the political currency you have, if you want, to put him into cabinet, but it won't come without a cost. You will be accused of engaging in nepotism, which he has been accused of, obviously. There's not a tremendous track record that Michael Ford can bring to the office as it relates to citizenship and multiculturalism. Okay. Having said all of that, he has been elected twice, Michael Ford, right? He got elected to Toronto School Board. He got elected to Toronto City Council. I've asked around about this guy for, for as long as he's been in public life. And most of what I hear come back at me about people who've worked with him is that he's a pretty good guy and that his heart's in the right place. He doesn't do the kind of politics that his uncle was famous for and his other uncle, Rob Ford, was famous for back in the day, which was sort of overly disruptive, populist, obnoxious politics just for the purposes of being disruptive. They say he plays well in the sandbox with others, and people should give him a chance. So that's what I have heard back. Obviously, there are going to be a lot of eyes on Michael Ford, and if he gets off to a good start, then the premier's judgment is going to be vindicated. And if he, you know, steps on some landmines in the first little while, people are going to say, you see, you shouldn't have put him in there. You put him in too soon. He should have had some time on the back benches to just sort of get his feet wet and get his bearings straight, and you promoted him too quickly. And I think it's fair to say as well, John Michael, as you pointed out, that there will be a lot of people on the back benches, more of them now that this caucus is bigger than the previous one, who thought, you know, I labored in the vineyards for 4 years for this party and for this premier. And then, you know, some no doubt have been conservative MPPs even longer than that. And they are still waiting for the phone to ring for a cabinet appointment. And here comes the premier's nephew, not having to wait long at all before getting in. So these kinds of things can cause a lot of friction and anger on the back benches. And that's another thing that the premier will certainly have to manage.
Worth noting here that Toronto Mayor John Tory and Premier Doug Ford had a press conference on Monday afternoon. This question, of course, came up, and John Tory, I guess you could say, rose to the defense of Michael Ford, saying that you know, he had worked with Ford as a city councillor, appointed him to the Toronto Police Services Board, had you know, a lot of respect for him, and you know, here's a bit of what he had to say.
He is thoughtful. He is hardworking. He does understand his community as well as anybody else, and it is one of the most multicultural communities in all of Toronto, if not all of Canada. And he will work hard. And so, you know, give him a chance.
You know, it's not exactly the case that this is a brand new issue. This kind of thing has been going on since President John F. Kennedy put his brother, Bobby Kennedy, into his cabinet as Attorney General. That happened 60 years ago, a little more than 60 years ago, actually. I can remember when Dalton McGuinty got the job as opposition leader in the province of Ontario, when he won the Liberal leadership. And one of the first things he did was hire one of his brothers to be his chief of staff. There was a huge hue and cry about that, and the appointment did not last long. For whatever reason, Mr. McGuinty wanted somebody he deeply trusted to be his chief of staff, and the public didn't take well to it, and the appointment was rescinded, I think only a matter of a week or so later. So, you know, and one more example, if I can, Jean Chrétien, when he was Prime Minister of Canada, he appointed his nephew, Raymond Chrétien, to be ambassador to Washington. There weren't very many howls of nepotism in that case, actually, because Raymond Chrétien had been a lifelong public servant, had a history with foreign affairs, and so had the chops to take the job, and by all accounts did well in the job. That's the one thing that Michael Ford has not got going for him here. He does not have this long history upon which to call to say, yes, I deserve this job. There's no question he got this job because his last name's Ford. Now it will be up to him to vindicate his uncle's judgment.
We've already talked about, of course, some people are appointed to cabinet and some people are disappointed to not be in cabinet anymore. Three names in this shuffle, people who were cabinet ministers and will not be anymore. You've got Lisa McLeod, the MPP for Nepean, who had been in Doug Ford's cabinet for all of the previous 4 years. Ross Romano, the Sault Ste. Marie MPP, who was, I believe, the last Tory to win a seat in the legislature before the 2018 election sweep. He's one of the last MPPs to serve any time in opposition before they became the government. You know, flipped that seat from a Liberal seat to a Conservative one. Served in a few different cabinet roles, will no longer, at least not for the time being. And then Nina Tangri, who announced shortly before the cabinet was unveiled on Friday that she will be seeking election as Speaker of the House when the House returns. The first order of business will be MPPs electing a Speaker. I actually haven't seen if Ted Arnott is going to seek the job again.
He is.
Yeah, well, there we go. And I would assume the way things usually go at the House that if Ted Arnott wants the job, he is very, very likely to get elected again by his peers. And but Nina Tangri can do as she chooses. And either she will succeed in becoming the next speaker, or I think more likely, even if she is not elected as the speaker, she may get a role as a deputy speaker. That's traditionally something that happens for people who fail to get the top job in the legislature.
Right. Now, let's drill down a little deeper and talk about, first of all, gender balance in the cabinet and then geographic representation. And many observers have pointed out that there are 7 women now in a cabinet of 30. And as a percentage of the cabinet, women now make up fewer cabinet positions than they did in the previous Ford government. So for those who are looking for more gender balance in this cabinet, you're going to be disappointed because there is actually less gender balance. In terms of geographic representation, how many times have we talked on this podcast, John Michael, about how the 905 pretty much decides elections these days because the 905 seats are almost always in play? Well, the 905 overwhelmingly voted Conservative this time, and as a result, they have the largest chunk of cabinet seats by a long shot. We're talking now Halton, Peel, Durham, and York regions. The 905 MPPs 11 of them made it into cabinet. 11 of 30 cabinet ministers are from the 905. The 416, the capital city, Toronto, has 6. Central Ontario riding's got 5. Eastern Ontario, 3. Northern Ontario, 3. Hamilton, Niagara, 1. That's Neil Lumsden, the former Ticat star. And Southwestern Ontario only got 1. That's Monty McNaughton, the Labour Minister. Now, I guess I should point out here that I said 3 in the North. There are people who are saying that there are actually 4 in the North, that Graydon Smith from Parry Sound Muskoka is actually the 4th Northern Cabinet Minister. And I'm sorry, I'm just not going to say that. I've looked at a map of the province of Ontario. Parry Sound Muskoka is not in Northern Ontario. Yes, technically speaking, it is considered part of Northern Ontario as it relates to special Northern Ontario programs and the added subsidies that businesses in that part of the province can apply for under the aegis of being in Northern Ontario. But that only happened because 40 years ago, a previous Parry Sound Muskoka MPP named Ernie Eves, who went on to become premier, lobbied for and got Parry Sound, his riding, into what was considered Northern Ontario. And therefore, because he wanted the extra benefits for his riding. And therefore, some people say there are 4 Northern ministers. But JMM, come on now. I've looked at the map of Northern Ontario. Parry Sound and Muskoka are not in Northern Ontario. So I say 3 for the North, although others may say 4. So there you go. Now, what about diversity?
Well, before I get to that, I will just say this is my favorite controversy in all of Ontario geography. Not since we had to fight Manitoba for the border of northwestern Ontario have we had this kind of firepower.
There you go. It's a biggie.
Now, on matters of diversity, not surprisingly, because so few cabinet files actually changed hands, a lot of people from the previous cabinet, which was much more diverse than the cabinet that Doug Ford started off with, let me put it that way. So a lot of the same faces are still in cabinet. This includes 3 South Asian people, 2 East Asian people, 1 Persian MPP, 1 Jewish MPP, and 1 Black MPP, which also happens to be the first Black woman in cabinet for this premier. There have been Black women in cabinets before. I think of Mitzi Hunter, who was still an MPP in the Liberal caucus. She held a number of different cabinet files under Kathleen Wynne. But this is the first Black woman in cabinet for this progressive conservative government.
Yeah, Liberals and New Democratic governments in the past have both had Black women in cabinet, and this is the first time that it has happened for the Tories. Charmaine Williams, who's the new MPP for Brampton Centre, she makes history as the first Black female cabinet minister for a progressive conservative government. Now, one of the things that you and I both noticed when we were at the swearing-in on Friday is that there weren't very many protesters there, which kind of surprised me because this is hardly what you'd call not a polarizing government. They have had some issues with protesters in the past, but security did keep protesters pretty far away from Queen's Park. The roads were blocked off in many directions. A very few number of protesters did, however, get through. And there was a contingent chanting at various moments in the swearing-in ceremony, 50K is not okay. 50K is not okay. That's what they were chanting. Why don't you tell us what that was all about, JMM?
These were protesters from the Ontario Autism Coalition, children or the parents of children living with autism, waiting for provincially funded services. Autism funding has been a file this government has been really roundly criticized on, more or less since the beginning of this government. They promised to clear the backlog of services that had grown under the Liberals. That backlog just continued to grow. And now the number is a bit more than 50,000 families waiting for funding from the provincial government, hence the chant 50K is not okay, and of course a hashtag as well that was trending through much of the cabinet unveiling ceremony. It was just one of those things where every once in a while we were there on the front lawn and the invited guests who are, let's put it bluntly, friendly to the government, would start cheering and clapping, and I wasn't always sure what was happening. And then you realize, oh, they're trying to drown out the chanting protesters. And then you realize, oh, that's why we're hearing all the applause.
Exactly. Now, let me touch on 2 other things. One of them I think is kind of funny, and one of them not so much. Needless to say, I've been to a lot of these swearing-ins, and I have never seen a minister sworn in who was as funny as Ted McMeekin. Ted McMeekin was a liberal during the McGuinty years. He represented a riding around the Hamilton area. And you know that after they swear the oath, those who want to, you don't have to, but those who want to, finish off by saying, "So help me God." And Ted McMeekin, when it was his turn, he put a beautiful pause in just the right place, and it got everybody laughing hysterically. He said his oath, and then he got to the part where he went, "So help me God," but he said, "So," and then he paused, and he looked up to the sky, and he said, "Help me God." And it was just, it was the pause, it was the way he said it, it was just very, very funny. So Ted McMeekin, I still wanted to give him a shout out on this podcast to remind everybody that he still got, in my view, the best swearing-in ceremony ever. Okay, that's the funny thing. The thing that I think is not so funny is, you know, every cabinet swearing-in I've attended, and as I say, I've been to a few, after it's over, the premier takes questions for a few minutes, and then one by one, by one by one, the newly appointed ministers come to the microphone, they maybe answer one or two questions, and of course, most of the questions are, what do you want to do with your portfolio? And most of the answers are, well, I just got it 5 minutes ago, so, you know, ask me again in 2 months. But it doesn't matter. We like to have access to these newly appointed ministers because sometimes they say things that are of real interest and import. And for example, I would love to know what the first black female Tory cabinet minister ever appointed thinks about breaking that barrier. I would love to know about Neil Lumsden, who's the first former Canadian Football League player in almost 100 years to get an appointment. I'd love to know what he thought about going into cabinet. I'd like to know about what Sylvia Jones, what plan she has for spending $65 billion of our tax dollars over the next year as the Minister of Health for the province of Ontario, and whether she thinks she can juggle all of that along with being the Deputy Premier. Anyway, and on it goes. There are questions that could be asked. There are answers that should have been given. But apparently we're still in campaign mode here because nobody was made available at all. And I was under the impression that now that the election had been won victoriously by the Conservatives, they might go back to making their premier and their ministers more accessible to the media and answering our questions, but apparently not.
I will say that there were some scrums with some of the new ministers, if reporters were able to hunt them down on that front lawn as the ceremony started to break up. I know some of my colleagues were able to get questions with Michael Ford, for example. But it's not really organized. It's a bit of a chase, and it doesn't necessarily give you the opportunity to get questions into all the ministers who you want to question. Is this the end of the world? I mean, it's irritating for reporters, and it's not how previous governments have done it. And I think it's worth talking about it in that context, why this stuff irritates us, because we have a job to do too. And stuff
yeah, I'm
like
not
this.
Irritated on my behalf. I'm irritated on behalf of the people of Ontario who don't get questions that they may have of these
precisely.
New people answered. I mean, that's the thing. We're not, you know, we're not complaining in our beer here about woe is us, poor us, we didn't get to do these scrums. You're right. This is our job. We're trying to bring information to the public, and the people around the premier have decided to make it more difficult than it probably needs to be.
On the topic of access, the Premier's office did confirm that the Premier is choosing not to make the mandate letters for his new cabinet public. Of course, we've talked about this before on the podcast. This matter will now be decided at the Supreme Court. This is an issue that's now gone through several Ontario courts. The most recent decision was from the Court of Appeals, which decided that the government should be required to release cabinet mandate letters under Ontario's Access to Information legislation. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the appeal of this issue, so it is possible that the Supreme Court will reverse those lower court decisions and side with the provincial government and say, like, actually, no, they are not required to release these documents. Or the Supreme Court could back up the decisions of the lower courts. And then the province could simply choose to amend Ontario's access to information legislation and render the whole issue moot. We will see. That is obviously something that we will pay attention to as it moves forward. While the government was not abundantly available to us on that Friday, the New Democrats did put forward their caucus chair, Jeff Birch. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Here's what the official NDP wants from this cabinet. Table a new budget. hire tens of thousands of healthcare workers to tackle the painfully long waits, hire thousands of teachers and education workers so our kids can have smaller class sizes and more help. Rip up Bill 124 now, so working people have a fighting chance to afford the cost of inflation. I will also add that we find the priorities in this cabinet to be backward. Ford has created new extra portfolios, but he's still only got a part-time minister of long-term care. And while Doug Ford's low-wage policy, Bill 124, is holding people's wages back during a time of crushing inflation, Ford is growing his cabinet so more of his own people get a raise.
Now, you heard Birch there refer to some of the new ministries this cabinet shuffle has created. What has happened there is that some of the ministries have been broken up to spread the work around with more hands. Maybe the most notable case here is Greg Rickford, who for much of the last 4 years has held some of the most important cabinet posts specifically for Northern Ontario at various times, well, for all of the last 4 years, and he continues to hold the file for Indigenous Affairs. But he's previously held energy, northern development and mines, natural resources and forestry. So now he continues to hold Indigenous Affairs and northern development, but mines has been split off and handed to former Timmins mayor and new MPP George Peary. He will have a special mandate to get the road to the Ring of Fire built and open and operating.
And that makes some sense. After all, he's a former mining executive, so he knows the sector extremely well. And, you know, I've asked around about George Peary, and all of what's come back to me so far is that he's a very capable, competent guy and somebody we should keep our eye on. So we will do that. Now, one person whose job has not changed at all is Peter Bethlen-Falvey. He is still the finance minister for the province of Ontario. And, well, if he'd planned to get away for a long vacation in July, he may have to reevaluate those plans. Tell us why.
The government still needs to pass the budget. Technically, they can keep spending money into the fall, but a budget has two documents. There's the budget plan, and then there's the legislation that the government introduces to the House to pass the all of the legislative measures if they want to change tax rates, that kind of thing. They never passed the legislation in the spring. They went straight to an election. So now they have to actually pass that legislation. There's things that they don't want to wait on. They don't want to wait until the fall. They want to get that stuff done. So they are going to bring the House back. The Premier confirmed on Monday they're looking for a short summer session. They can't get right to work with the budget. They have to, we've mentioned, they have to elect a speaker. They also have to hear a throne speech. The lieutenant governor will deliver a speech laying out the government's agenda since the election. Those two items, electing a speaker and hearing a throne speech, those each traditionally take a day to happen.
And have they yet set a date for when this will all take place?
No, the Premier was asked at the press conference on Monday whether he had a specific date. He is still squishy on the details there, I will say. It could, in theory, you know, we are recording this week. In theory, it could be as quickly as the Tuesday after Canada Day. Like, that's one scenario where you bring the MPPs back on the Tuesday after Canada Day. They elect their speaker on Tuesday. They hear the throne speech on Wednesday, and then they have the budget speech on Thursday, and then the following week they debate the budget. That, I think, is probably the fastest it could realistically occur. It could be even later than that, but I think, you know, if I'm just going to prognosticate here a little bit, I really strongly suspect none of these MPPs want to still be at Queen's Park when the August long weekend rolls around.
You think?
these people are human beings. They have been through an extremely busy time. If you actually haven't been in an election, I think it's easy to ignore just how grueling, how physically exhausting it can be. And I think I would not be surprised if there was just not a huge appetite to really drag out the budget debate. This is going to be very close to the exact same document that was presented in the spring in May. The people of Ontario got their chance to see that document and effectively ratify it. So I think even among the opposition parties, there, at least for a little bit, there's going to be some attitude of, you know what, the people had their say on this one. We don't need to drag this out, you know, kicking and screaming all the way. They will voice their opposition to the parts that they are still opposed to. And indeed, Jeff Birch, you know, talked about the parts of the budget that they still think are inadequate. But I would not be surprised if this still went through the legislature pretty hastily. One last thing before we go. Steve, you had lunch on Saturday with a notable person in Ontario political history. Please tell us about that.
Well, I wanted to raise this just because, speaking of budgets, this guy brought in his share of budgets as well. I'm talking about Robert Nixon. Mr. Nixon is a four-time former leader of the Ontario Liberal Party and was the minister, wasn't actually called Minister of Finance at the time. It was still called the Treasurer of Ontario from 1985 to 1990. So he brought in budgets for the David Peterson government in the late 1980s. Mr. Nixon is now 93 years old. He will turn 94 next month. And my goodness, he's still got game. There's a bunch of us who get together and with him probably once or twice a year. And we go out and we hear the greatest old war stories from back in the day in politics. You got to remember, he first got elected in 1962 after his father, who was Premier of Ontario in 1943, died, necessitated a by-election, and he picked up the torch and got elected after that. And he was in the legislature. His dad's the longest-serving MPP of all time. Mr. Nixon was in the legislature from 62, I guess, until about 91. So he had almost three straight decades in there. And, you know, it's just wonderful to see somebody still so engaged in public life of today, with opinions and in good health and, you know, weighing in on all sorts of stuff. So that was a very enjoyable lunch, and I wanted to just get it on the record that Bob Nixon is still doing his thing. He's still crusty and lots of fun.
I'm glad you had a good weekend.
We did. And I should also say, one of the other guys who was at that lunch, because we had lunch on the banks of the Grand River in Paris, Ontario, the former constituency of Dave Levesque, who I think is the longest serving speaker in the history of the Ontario legislature. And we saw him for the first time, I think, since COVID. So first time I've seen him in a few years as well. And it was great to see the former speaker as well. We always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have that immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We do love your feedback, good, bad, or indifferent.
A shout out to an Apple Podcast user by the name of Aionic, who called us exceptional. Aionic praises your lines of questioning and historical knowledge, Steve.
I think that just means I'm old. anyway, and I know he loves your immense knowledge on Ontario political and policy-based stuff as well, JMM. So thank you, Aionic. And we will, we're going to have a good chat about that suggestion of yours that we take questions every week when we return in the fall. So yeah, we'll run that up the flagpole and see if it flies.
That's right. We will be taking a short break over the summer, but we will return. So if you have questions, feel free to email us now.
And if you've got ideas, as Aionic does for our podcast, when we're back, shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Or tweet at us. I'm at JM_McGrath.
And I'm at S. Paikin. That's S-P-A-I-K-I-N. We also like to remind you to read our weekly On Poly newsletter, which drops every Tuesday as well, just like the podcast. You can subscribe to that newsletter at tvo.org/newsletters. And of course, guess what this week's newsletter is all about? Of course, it's about the cabinet shuffle. Here now, my quote of the week, and we're going to go back to the south side of Queen's Park last Friday, Premier Doug Ford with an appeal to the people of Ontario.
And as long as I am Premier, this government will strive every day to represent all of our great province. Our blue-collar workers, our labour unions, entrepreneurs and innovators, drivers and transit riders, seniors and young families, newcomers looking for good work and the Ontario dream, urban, suburban, and rural communities in every region of the province. This is Team Ontario.
That's Ontario's 26th Premier, Doug Ford, at the swearing-in ceremony last Friday.
And here's my quote of the week, Ojibwe Elder Gary Sue doing an Indigenous welcome, which is new for this government, and adding a note of humor for the proceedings.
They didn't give me a time limit. So I don't want to become an instant politician either. Meek wins.
That's Elder Gary Hsu, not turning into an instant politician.
And that is the On Poly podcast for June 28th, 2022, produced by Tiffany Lamb, edited by Matthew O'Mara.
With production support from Nikki Ashworth, Jonathan Hallowell, and Albert Wisco, our managing editor is Katie O'Connor.
Now, as we sit here taping this thing, not really taping, what do you call it? Since there's no tape involved, what do you say? Recording?
Recording.
Okay, as we sit here recording this thing, let's just remind everybody that there was a fantastic Stanley Cup series that just concluded, and Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the NHL, did not hand the Stanley Cup, as is the tradition, to the captain of the Colorado Avalanche. Why not? Because he's got COVID. So everybody, I know you think COVID's over, but it isn't. So, as we all go off on our summer breaks here, and I will remind everybody, as I like to say on this podcast, stay positive, test negative. That's my dad's line. Stay away from the COVID, everybody. Take care of yourself.
Stay safe, Steve, and we'll see you in the fall.